Did Jesus really rise from the dead, or is that just a myth that Christians believe? And if he did rise from the dead, what did he look like after his resurrection? We'll discuss those questions on this week's episode of the Faith by Reason podcast. Welcome to the podcast. The website behind it all, as always, is faithbyreason.net. There you will find hundreds of hours of study material, blogs and podcasts, and coming soon, video. That's right. Once we get past the series on Jesus and we get into the sixth dispensation and we start talking about the church, we are actually going to start a series on the book of Revelation, and that will be simulcast via podcast and YouTube video. So that's exciting. And so get ready for that in the next couple months later this year. So now that we have concluded the series on the Redeemer, the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, we're starting to look at some of the myths that we have around Jesus, myths that are secular as well as religious and even Christian. We began in the last podcast by looking at the secular myths around Jesus, whether he really existed and if Christianity is even a valid faith belief based on what the disciples said and what they didn't say and whether or not they were real or con men or things like that. And we looked at all of that and we saw that it was pretty much ridiculous. There is historical evidence that Jesus existed, that he did what he said he did. And those sources are secular sources, independent objective sources that document his entire life. And we also showed how ridiculous it is to believe that the disciples faked his death and started this religion for fame and fortune when they got no fame, no fortune. They were actually all brutally killed and tortured to death. And in order to stop that torture, all they had to do was admit that it was a con, and they didn't do it. So obviously it was because it was real, and there were eyewitnesses at the time of what happened. So there is no logical reason to doubt that Jesus existed, that he did what he said he did, and that his disciples spread a legitimate faith based on what they saw and heard and witnessed about him and spread it throughout the world. So in this podcast, we're going to wrap up the myth series by looking at one more myth. We're looking at myths about his resurrection. One of the myths being a secular myth is absolutely ridiculous. And the only reason I'm even bringing it up is because it's still taken seriously in secular circles, in education, in theology, in secular theology classes. So I need to present it just for that fact. And then we're going to wrap it up by looking at a very subtle and pervasive myth that is actually believed by Christians. It is something that we Christians actually take for granted. And again, like I said, it's very subtle. It's almost innocuous to the point that we accept it without even thinking about it. But if we look at it carefully, we'll see that this myth can actually be pretty damaging. And I will say from the start that every time I have presented this myth to other Christians, well, not every time, I'll say 99% of the time, I will say that of all the Christians I've presented it to, only about a handful, I can count on one hand the number of people who have accepted it. The vast majority violently reject this second myth I'm going to present to you. However, when they reject it, they can never give me a logical reason as to why they think it's false. So again, prepare yourself for that. Okay, so let's begin with the secular myth about the resurrection of Jesus. And this is something called the swoon theory, swoon, S-W-O-O-N theory. And this theory states that, and of course, secular people do not believe in the supernatural. They don't believe that Jesus really rose from the dead. And the swoon theory purports to disprove the resurrection by stating that not only did Jesus not rise from the dead, but the reason he didn't rise from the dead is because he never actually died. That's right. The swoon theory states that Jesus didn't die on the cross. He was crucified, of course. You can't get away from that because, again, there is secular history, objective history, that show that Jesus was crucified. But the people who perpetrate the swoon theory state that he didn't die on the cross. What happened was he was in such great pain due to the crucifixion that he actually just fainted. He passed out. He swooned. He went, and just passed out due to all the pain of the resurrection, like a 1950s actress who falls out on a fainting couch because she just can't take it anymore. This whatever shocking news she got or whatever she saw that was so horrible, she just swooned and just gently fainted. That's what happened to Jesus. He didn't really die on the cross. He just fainted from the pain. But when he fainted, the Roman soldiers thought he was dead. They thought his fainting spell was actually death. So they took him down off the cross, put him into the tomb, rolled the stone in front of the tomb, and they put the still alive but fainted Jesus into the tomb. But what happened is after 3 days of being in the tomb, the cool air of the tomb revived him. And he woke up all full of vigor, and he walked out of the tomb past the Roman soldiers, and he went off and married Mary Magdalene, and they started having kids, and those children, the progeny of Jesus, that royal bloodline, actually became the bloodline of most Northern European royalty, the kings of France and England and the Netherlands and Sweden, and all the Northern European royalty actually have the royal blood of Jesus from his adventures, his sexual adventures with Mary Magdalene, and all their children became the royal houses of Europe. And yes, that is as ridiculously stupid as it sounds. The question to ask is, does anyone actually believe this nonsense? And shockingly, a great number of people do, and we'll talk about them in a minute. But before we talk about who believes this nonsense, let's just look really quickly at most of the reasons why this is absolutely ludicrous. If we looked at all the reasons, it would take all day, but I only have a few minutes because I want to get to the second half of the myths. So let's just look at why this is dumb. First of all, Jesus fainting on the cross and the Roman soldiers thinking he was dead. Remember, we talked about this in a couple of podcasts ago, what happens during crucifixion. And while it is painful, pain is not the only thing that happens. A lot of things happen to your body. It's actually a physiologically devastating event that happens to you when you're crucified. You suffer massive organ failure. Almost all of your internal organs fail, including your heart. And the heart's kind of important to your body in case, even if you're not a doctor, I think you're probably smart enough to know that if your heart is pretty important to your overall well-being, and crucifixion causes your heart to literally rupture. Your heart is a muscle, and because of the stress that's put on by crucifixion, your heart literally tears. As I said a few podcasts ago, Jesus actually died of a broken heart. His heart tore. His lungs were filled with fluid. His major organs all failed. He didn't. Fainting is the least of your issues. And also, you would not have fainted. Here's the thing. The Romans were expert executioners. They did not invent Christianity the week before Jesus was crucified. They were not novices at this. Actually, the Persians invented crucifixion 300 years before the crucifixion of Christ. The Romans took that form of execution, and they perfected it to the point where they knew it was a torturous death. People would be on the cross normally for up to a week. And the Romans carefully made sure that they did not pass out. They would not die before the Romans wanted them to die. It was a long, torturous death. The Romans knew what they were doing. There was not a lot of blood loss, but it was a very, very long and torturous death. Furthermore, and this is very important, not only were Romans expert executioners, they were experts at knowing when someone was dead. If Jesus had merely fainted on the cross, they would have known the difference between someone who had fainted and someone who was dead. As much as we like to think that people in ancient times were just a bunch of, backwards hillbillies who didn't know anything about medicine, they actually knew a lot. And as I've said in previous podcasts, there are many reasons to believe that ancient people were actually more sophisticated in their science than we are today. We have better toys, don't get me wrong. They didn't have, iPods and, satellite radio and HD TV back then, but they were very sophisticated in what they did know. And they knew the difference between a dead body and a living body. For one thing, even if you faint, you're still going to breathe. When a person faints, their chest still goes up and down as they're breathing. So the Roman soldiers would have known that. In fact, the reason that the Roman soldiers stuck Jesus in the side with a spear was not because he was being sadistic. We all know that. He was poked in his side and blood and water came out. That the Roman soldier who poked him in the side with a spear did not do that because he was trying to be mean necessarily. He was checking to see if he was dead. Why? Well, because we know from medical science, and actually Luke, this is mentioned pretty prominently in the book of Luke, and Luke, as you probably know, was a doctor. Luke was a physician. This is why he's the only gospel writer who mentioned this specifically, that when the Roman soldier poked him in the side with a spear, blood and water came out. Why did we know that? Because when a person dies, when your blood is no longer pumping, then something happens to the blood. You see, your blood is made of two substances. There are the red blood cells, which are relatively solid, but the fluid that which is the medium for which your blood travels through your body, it's called plasma. Plasma on its own is kind of clear. It's kind of yellowish, but it's mostly clear. When you die, and your heart is no longer pumping your blood, the blood platelets, the red blood cell platelets, separate from the plasma. And if you were to see the blood of a dead person, you would see a red, thick, sludgy part of it, and you'd also see the relatively clear plasma. So when Luke said that blood and water came out, that proves that Jesus was dead, because only in a dead body does the blood separate into the thick, red, sludgy platelets and the relatively clear plasma. That Roman soldier was making sure that Jesus was dead. A living body, you will not see blood and water. Again, they didn't have a word for plasma, so they called it water. That showed that Jesus was absolutely dead. The Roman soldiers knew what they were doing. So he did not faint. He was absolutely dead. But the swoon theory people want you to believe that somehow the Roman soldiers just forgot overnight how to do their executions. And then Jesus was, even though he had suffered massive organ failure. And also, remember we talked about what happens in your crucifixion when they put the nails into your lower hand, basically the area between your hand and your wrist. It permanently severs the nerve that controls the muscles of your hand. Your hand permanently becomes a claw. You can't move your hand anymore. And also, when you put the nails through the feet, it shatters the plantar bone and your feet are useless. But the swoon theorists would have you believe that Jesus suffered massive organ failure, but cool air from the tomb healed all his wounds. And then he basically got up on unusable feet, hobbled over to the tomb, to the stone of the tomb, rolled a 2-ton stone away using unusable hands, and then snuck past a Roman guard, 16 guards. We talked about this in the last podcast. 16 Roman soldiers who were guarding him under penalty of death, and then went off to stud himself off with Mary Magdalene. So I think we've discovered a new medical miracle. I mean, let's forget about when people have trauma, let's forget about surgery and medicine and things like that. All we need to do when someone has a trauma and they have a car accident or they have cancer or they're suffering organ failure, just throw them into a tomb for 3 days. And obviously, cool tomb air will heal all their wounds and make them perfectly viable, like it happened with Jesus, according to the swoon theory. Utterly, ridiculously, spectacularly stupid theory. But it's there, the swoon theory. So why do I even bring up something this, again, galactically, universally, idiotically, stupidly moronic? The reason I do is because, believe it or not, the swoon theory is actually still taught to this day in universities. Professors, doctorates, been in school for 12 years, still teach this nonsense. Not only is it taught in schools, it's actually been the basis for a couple of popular books. There was a book that came out in, I think, the late 80s, maybe early 90s, called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, written by a couple of guys. They were from the British Isles. I think they were Scottish, maybe Irish. Anyway, they wrote this book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which used the swoon theory as their basis. They believe that, again, Jesus didn't die. He came out. He had Mary Magdalene, had a bunch of kids, and those kids became British and French and Northern European royalty. And they use the swoon theory as their basis for believing this. And again, it was a popular book. It actually shook the faith of many Christians, because unfortunately, many of our fellow Christians are just completely uneducated in apologetics. And they believed this. And it was like, oh my God, these guys have researched it. They have proof that shows that Jesus really lived and he had kids. And these kids are the royal bloodline. Nonsense. Complete nonsense. And Holy Blood, Holy Grail, again, it's completely false. It's fairly well-written, and it was researched pretty well, however, they're relying on very specious sources when they get down to the history of the first century. I mean, they're using Gnostics and Gnostic Gospels and things like that, which are completely unproven. Then there's also another series of books written by a man named Dan Brown. Perhaps you've heard of him. He came up with a book called The Da Vinci Code, which was very popular in the early aughts, around 2001, 2002, I guess, when he wrote The Da Vinci Code. People believed that too, and it had the same premise that Jesus didn't die. He had kids with Mary Magdalene, and like the Holy Grail, which is like one of the Catholic myths that you know, the Holy Grail is supposed to be the cup of Christ, the cup that Jesus drank out of at the Last Supper, that somehow has magical powers, which is again ridiculous and secular and pagan. But according to Dan Brown, the Holy Grail is actually the holy bloodline of Jesus. And again, using this whole swoon theory of Mary Magdalene nonsense, and it amazes me that people even read this book, because not only is it poorly researched, it's written at a really poor level. I mean, if you look at it, it's written at like a fifth grade level. It's not a very complex, well-written book. Dan Brown is not a talented writer at all. His books are just really infantile in the way they're put together. But unfortunately, I think that's a commentary on our current American education system, where a popular book is going to be written at an elementary school level, and I guess people understand it better because, again, we're just so poorly educated in this country that a book written at a low level appeals to us. But again, it's utter nonsense. It's completely secular, and it makes no sense. But and the only reason I brought it up is, again, because it's still taught in schools and it's still the subject of popular novels. But it's all easily refutable if you just take 5 minutes to think about things logically, which, sadly, most of us, Christian and secular, do not do. I want to take a moment here to just talk about something. I want to let you know that I understand that if you're listening to this and you're in the past couple of podcasts and you're reading and listening about all the things that secular people do to try to disparage Christianity, and it could get you down. I understand. Sometimes it bothers me too, but keep something in mind. All the ways that the secular people in the world try to disprove Christianity, don't let it get you down. In fact, it should be encouraging to you. You should be encouraged by the fact that people attack Christianity. Why? Because the fact that people attack Christianity so vociferously is one of the proof points, one of the things that I use to prove that Christianity is actually true. Because if Christianity wasn't true, if Christianity was just a fairy tale that secular people and atheists want you to believe it is, why would they spend so much time attacking it? They wouldn't. The only reason you attack something is if you think it's a threat to you. Christianity is a threat to Satan, to his minions, secular and otherwise, and that's why they attack it. No one spends this same amount of time attacking Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism. You will not find books written by the so-called new atheists like, you know, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris. Sure, they'll mention Islam here and there, but they really only attack Christianity. And the reason they attack it is because it's true. If it wasn't true, they wouldn't be threatened by it. I mean, look at the way our society is now. When I was growing up, you know, it was a while back, but you know, not terribly long ago when I was a kid, being a Christian was actually a positive thing. You know, if you wanted to get along in society, if you wanted to get a high level of recognition in society, to be a mayor or a governor or something like that, you had to be considered a church-going Christian. That was something that was considered, a good thing to be. And if you weren't that, then you were disparaged. Now it's the opposite. Now if you're a Christian, you're a bigot, you're intolerant, you're a horrible human being. It's gone completely in the opposite direction. And if you watch any television shows or any movies, it's like it's almost a requirement that you bash Christianity. When you look, I watch TV shows, and what I see, there are two things that are absolutely requirements. It's like they have to check it off the list if you have a TV show or a movie. One, you have to have a gay character. You have to have at least one gay character. And by the way, that gay character will always be better than the straight characters. They'll be smarter and funnier and just better morally, but the gay character has to be in your movie or TV show, it has to be elevated to a higher level than the straight people. That's number one. Every movie, every TV show has to have a gay character. Oh, and bonus points if they're transgender. That's if you have a transgender character, you're on top of the world then. So that's one. And number two, you have to bash Christianity. I mean, I'll be watching a television show with my wife and we're enjoying it, and then out of nowhere, they have to bash Christianity. They have to talk about how dumb Christianity is, how dumb Christians are, how stupid and intolerant and ignorant and bigoted Christians are. Even if the show has nothing to do with religion, they just have to throw in some dig on Christianity. It's like it's required. It's like in Hollywood, you have to check it off your list. But again, to me, that is a proof point, because if Christianity was not real, if it was not a real threat to Satan and his agenda, they wouldn't bother attacking it, because no one attacks Buddhism. No one attacks Hinduism. When was the last time you saw a movie that said anything bad about Hinduism or Buddhism? You can't attack Islam either, even though the Islamic people actually do all the stuff they claim Christians do. They claim Christians are intolerant and that we hate women and hate minorities and we want a theocracy. None of that really happens in Christian America. But on the other hand, Islam is very anti-woman. I mean, you go to Saudi Arabia, women have to be dressed head to toe in black with only their eyes visible. Women have fewer, if any, rights in Islamic countries. There is no religious freedom in Islamic countries. If you're a Christian, you're persecuted. If you're anything other than Islamic, you're persecuted. But the secular left, that's their favorite religion, is Islam. Even though Islam, again, is antithetical to all the things that the secular left claim they love, like, you know, again, gay rights. If you're gay, by the way, gay, you get the death penalty in most Islamic countries. Even though the left loves Islam and that you can't say anything bad about Islam or you're a bigot, even though, again, Islam embodies all the things that the left claim to hate. So anyway, I'm going to let that go. Let's move on to the final myth. And as I said before, this is the myth that Christians adhere to, and it's very subtle, very innocuous, and I will say that every single time, again, with few exceptions, every time I present this myth to Christians, it is violently rejected without cause. No one can ever give me a logical reason why they don't believe what I'm about to say, so prepare yourself, and here we go. I think the best way to present this myth is by looking at the Bible and looking at some of the appearances of Jesus after his resurrection. Now, the first person to see Jesus after he rose from the dead was Mary Magdalene. She went to the tomb early on that Sunday morning, Resurrection Sunday, to anoint Jesus' body with spices, you know, to complete his embalming. He wasn't there. She saw two angels saying, "Hey, why are you looking for the living among the dead?" And the verses, by the way, for all these instances I'll put them in the show notes, or most likely I'll put a link to the blog where I document it all. So two angels say Jesus isn't here. And while Mary is contemplating this, Jesus actually approaches her. She turns around and sees him, but she thinks he's the gardener in the tomb. And she thinks the gardener took away Jesus' body, and she says, "Hey, if you just tell me where he is, and I'll go get him." And Jesus says, he says her name, he says, "Mary." And she had recognized his voice and said, "Oh, my Lord and my God." She said, "Rabboni." And then Jesus left because he had to go back to the Father. He had some other things to do. So that was the first appearance. The next time he appears, he appears to the disciples in the upper room. And he just appears out of nowhere. They're in a room, the four walls, and Jesus just appears. And they're frightened. They think he's a ghost. Actually, they say he's a spirit. And when you say spirit, it's not just ghost like we think of, you know, ghosts as like sometimes friendly apparitions or of relatives or whatnot. No, when they say spirit, they mean an evil spirit. They think that he is a Rephaim. And if you go to the series on the supernatural worldview, you know that a Rephaim is the disembodied spirit of a Nephilim. A Nephilim, they were the evil hybrids from Genesis chapter 6. So they thought that Jesus was an evil spirit. And Jesus said, no, handle me and see, touch me. A spirit does not have flesh and bone. And they touched him and knew it was Jesus. But when they first saw him, they thought he was, frankly, a demonic entity. That's interesting. Look at another appearance, the famous Road to Emmaus appearance. This happens when there are two of his disciples, not the 12, well, 11, with Judas is dead, not any of the 11 disciples that walked with him, but his greater circle of disciples. They're two guys. We don't know their names, but they were two followers of Jesus who were walking along talking about what had happened, and Jesus just comes along and starts walking with them, but they don't know it's him. And Jesus walks up to them and says, "Hey, guys," I'm paraphrasing here. And he says, "Hey, guys, what's happening? Why are you so down? Why do you look so sad?" And they look at him like, "Dude, where have you been?" Again, paraphrasing, of course. And they say, "You know, we were talking about what's gone on in the last few days, you know, with Jesus of Nazareth, who we thought was the Messiah. We thought he was going to redeem us. But, you know, he was killed. And it's been 3 days since he was buried." And Jesus gives them, first of all, he calls them foolish. He says, "You guys are foolish. Don't you get it?" And he gives him an Old Testament Bible study. And he says, "No, didn't you know the Christ?" And by the way, let me go back a step. when they say basically, yeah, you know, we're talking about this guy, you know, Jesus, who we were following, and you know, he was crucified, and all these things happened to him. All, you know, these things have been going on, and Jesus is like, really? What things? This is proof that Jesus has a sense of humor. Jesus has just endured being betrayed by one of his closest inner circle disciples, Judas. He was subjected to 3 illegal trials. He was beaten. He was whipped. He had to drag a cross, a heavy cross, all the way across the city. He was crucified and tortured to death. And he says, what things? What are you guys talking about? Yeah, Jesus' sense of humor. And but then Jesus says to them, he says, look, wasn't the Christ, talking about himself in the third person, wasn't he supposed to endure all these things? And he said, and it says in Luke, starting with Moses and through all the prophets, Jesus gives them an education of all the prophecies of the Messiah from the Old Testament. And they're just fascinated by it. And it's a 7-mile walk. So for 7 miles, they're walking with Jesus, not knowing it's him. And when they get to their homes, the 2 disciples, Jesus is like, he's going to, you know, continue on. And they say, oh, no, stay with us, have dinner with us. And then when Jesus goes into the house, he breaks the bread, which, by the way, is inappropriate technically, because the person who owns the house, they're supposed to break the bread, and the guests are supposed to just receive the bread. Breaking the bread means you're going to serve it. And if you are a guest, you don't serve. You receive service. But Jesus broke the bread. And then they recognized him when he broke the bread, probably because they saw the nail prints in his hand. And when they recognized him, Jesus disappeared. All right, pretty interesting. And so what do we see here? Are we noticing a pattern? People seem to have trouble recognizing Jesus after he rose from the dead. Why is this? And here's the myth. The myth that most Christians accept based on what we think about Jesus and the pictures that we see, the paintings that we see of Jesus in his resurrected body. He looks beautiful. He looks glorious. He's the only thing that he has that would even let you know that he was crucified are, you know, the 2 nail prints in his hands and the nail prints in his feet. But other than that, oh, he's just beautiful, glorious. He's our Christ. He's our Savior. He looks great. But I believe that's a myth. I don't believe that properly explains why people don't recognize him. I don't think he looked glorious. I think he was actually the opposite. But again, we Christians, and if you look at any of our pictures, the reason we would give for why they couldn't recognize him was because he was so glorious, so shining, so angelic, just so beautiful that he just didn't look like Jesus anymore because he was just so much better looking physically in his appearance than he was during his life, so people didn't know him. Again, that's the myth, and I think it's wrong, and I'm going to tell you why. Now, again, brace yourself. This is going to make you uncomfortable. So get ready for it. What did Jesus really look like after he came back from the dead? Well, in order to give you my theory, which again, as I said, most Christians I tell this to, they reject it outright. So I'm just brace yourself for it. Let's look at some of the things that are said about Jesus and what happened to him during the ordeal, his passion, the ordeal he dealt with during his death, his crucifixion and death. In the book of Isaiah, and you'll see the actual verse in the show notes in the blog post, it says that they plucked my cheek. This is one of the prophecies of Jesus during his crucifixion was that they plucked the cheek, basically meaning that they tore off his beard. Those degenerates, as part of their torment of Jesus, the Roman soldiers tore his beard off. They physically tore the hair off of his face. Now, I don't know if you've ever known anyone who's had a full beard and had it removed, but you know, you can't recognize them anymore. In fact, I can tell you a story. When I was working in the corporate world, back working in the big city, I was in marketing, and we had an IT guy who I was pretty friendly with. He would help me out a lot whenever my computer would have issues. He had a full beard, big, bushy beard. One day he shaved his beard off and he came in to work and I barely recognized him. Honestly, the only reason I recognized him was because he had, as you know, IT guys are kind of weird. He would always wear these shirts that had like 80s cartoons on them, like, you know, Thundercats and He-Man and Scooby-Doo and all that stuff. That's the only reason I knew who he was, because he looked completely different without his beard. Jesus would have had a full beard. If they tore off his beard, he would be pretty tough to recognize him. especially with the scar tissue. Let's keep going. I guess it's going to get even worse. Brace yourself. Another verse in Isaiah says that Jesus was marred beyond any other man. In fact, he didn't even look like the son of a man. What that means is that Jesus was so brutally beaten between the Jews who beat him physically and struck him with their fists and rods, as it says in the Bible, and the Roman soldiers who beat on him when they were getting ready for crucifixion. He was beaten so badly, inspired by Satan, obviously, who hates God and just took and reveled in the fact that he could physically torment the Son of God. They beat Jesus so badly that he was unrecognizable. His bones in his face were broken so badly that he didn't even look like a human being anymore. That's how badly he was beaten. So taking that all together, what would Jesus have looked like if he retained all his scars? And here's another myth. The myth is that Christians only believe that the only scars Jesus retained were the two nail prints in his hands and feet, the nail prints in his hands and feet, and the scar from the spear being thrust in his side. We believe that because of the famous Doubting Thomas incident, where Thomas was like one of the last disciples to see Jesus after his resurrection. He didn't believe it. And he said, I only believe it's Jesus if I put my fingers in his nail prints and put my hand into his side where he was speared. But so that's why we believe that those are the only scars that Jesus retained. But why do we believe that? We only believe it, again, because those are the scars that Thomas specifically asked for. But there's no other reason to believe that those are the only scars he retained. If he retained those scars, why wouldn't he have retained all of them? Why wouldn't he have also retained the scar tissue from having his beard torn off? Why wouldn't he retain the deformities on his face from having all the bones in his face broken and having his face marred so bad that he didn't look human anymore? There is no reason to believe that. There is no logical reason to believe that Jesus didn't retain all his scars. So what would he have really looked like? He would have looked like someone with a face with scar tissue from the beard being torn off. He would have looked like someone whose face was just deformed from all the brutality. He would have looked nothing like the handsome, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, goateed Jesus, long-haired Jesus that we see in all of our pictures. He would look nothing like that. He would look horribly disfigured from all the abuse he took when he was being crucified. But we never see that. We only see what I call the pristine corpse. Just hands and feet pierced. Other than that, he looks great. But does that make any sense? Now I know it's going to disturb you, because we don't want to think of Jesus as looking anything less than perfectly beautiful. We want our Lord and Savior to look handsome and lovely. He should look like a cross between Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio and George Clooney and Robert Redford. He should just look like the most handsome man ever. Because after all, he's Jesus. He's a perfect man. He's our Savior. We love him. So we want him to look good, because that's our personal pride speaking. We want Jesus to look good because we think that we value appearance more than anything else. But there's no reason to believe that. Now, before you get mad at me and say, oh, there's no way Jesus would look that bad, let's plug in my theory into what we've just talked about and see if it makes any sense. Let's look back at the instances of Jesus' appearances and people and how they reacted to him. When Mary Magdalene saw him, she thought he was the gardener. Now, understand a little bit about Jewish culture. In Jewish culture, if you touch anything dead, you were considered unclean. You were ceremonially unclean if you touch anything dead, which means if you worked in a cemetery, you touched dead things a lot, which means you were always unclean. So that would make being in a cemetery, working in a cemetery, an undesirable job. It would not be the job that you would expect anyone in high society to have. And the opposite, anyone who worked in the cemetery would probably be the dregs of society. Working in a cemetery was like, you know, doing a job that no one else wanted to do. So I guess you have to assume that cemetery workers illegally crossed the southern Israeli border and came in and did that work. I'm sorry, I got political for a second there. Forgive me. But it would not be the job you expect for someone gloriously beautiful. I mean, it would be like if you saw Brad Pitt or Leonardo DiCaprio walking down the street, stepping out of their Ferrari or their Mercedes in a $5,000 suit, walking down the street, would you think, oh, that must be a homeless guy? No, you wouldn't. You'd think, oh, this must be a superstar. Similarly, if Jesus was really beautiful and glorious, why would Mary Magdalene mistake him for someone who would have one of the lowest possible jobs in Israel? It makes no sense. On the other hand, if Mary Magdalene saw a guy with hideous scars and a deformed face, she'd probably think, yeah, that's the kind of guy who would probably end up working in a cemetery. Wouldn't that make more sense? Of course it would. When the disciples saw him in the upper room, and he appeared out of nowhere, and they thought he was a demon. They thought he was a spirit. They thought he was a Rephaim. Why would you believe that someone beautiful and glorious would be a demon? That makes no sense. On the other hand, if someone just appeared in front of you having hideous scars and facial deformities, yeah, you might think that person's a demonic spirit. Makes more sense, doesn't it? And on the road to Emmaus, those two disciples, when they were walking with Jesus, and if he was so glorious, wouldn't they have noticed that? Instead, they invited him into their home, probably because they saw a deformed, hideously scarred man and probably took pity on him and wanted him to have a meal with them because they figured he was probably a homeless guy who didn't have anything else going for him. Doesn't that make more sense? So for those of you who are upset with what I'm saying right now and don't want to think about how hideous Jesus might have appeared after his resurrection, I want to ask you a question I want you to deal with. Would it be wrong for Jesus to have retained all the scars of his crucifixion? Would that be wrong? And I'll let you deal with that. Because here's what I think. I think that when we get to heaven, when we see Jesus face to face, we are going to see him as he was, retaining all the scars, the brutally disfigured face, the scar tissue from the beard being torn off, his back being lacerated by all the whipping that he took, as well as his hands and feet being pierced and deformed, and his side being scarred from the spear. I think we're going to see all of that. Why? Why would Jesus present himself this way? Why would God want us to see his son brutalized? Well, in order to answer that question, I want to tell you a story that I heard once that I hope will bring this into focus for you. Here's a story. There was once a little girl who was starting school, and every day her mother, this little girl's mother, would drop her off in front of school, in front of the school, and the girl would go in. However, every time the girl went into school, the other children would tease her terribly. Because you see, her mother had third-degree burns all over her face. Her mother's face was horribly scarred by those burns. Her mother just looked terrible, and all the kids would tease her. Oh, look at your mother. Your mother looks terrible. And it would just torment the little girl. And one day, the little girl said to her mother, she said, "Look, Mom, I don't want you to drop me off in front of the school anymore. I want you to drop me off a block away, and I'll walk the rest of the way to school because I'm just really tired of all the kids making fun of you and making me feel bad about this." And the mother said, "Okay, I understand. But before I agree to drop you off where you want me to, I need to tell you a story about how I got these scars. I've never told you this before. You see, when you were a little baby, when you were just an infant, I had placed you down for your nap one day, and I had gone out into the garden in the backyard to do some gardening. And while I was there, there was an electrical shortage in the house, and it caused the house to catch on fire. And I looked up, and I saw the fire raging. I saw the smoke coming out of your room. And I went up because I wanted to save you from the fire. But that shortage happened right near your room. So when I went up to save you, there was a wall of fire between me and your room. So I took a blanket and I covered myself in that blanket and I just dove through that fire because I needed to save you. And I saw you were in your crib, you were crying, you were choking on the smoke, so I wrapped you in the blanket because I wanted to protect you. And I had to get out of the house to save us both. But without that blanket, I had no protection. There was nothing to protect me from the fire, but I didn't care because all that mattered to me was saving my little girl. So I wrapped you in that blanket and I ran through that fire as fast as I could. But in doing so with no protection, I suffered second and third degree burns over most of my body and all over my face. But that didn't matter to me. The only thing that mattered was that I was able to save my little girl, that you were alive and well. And what happened to me didn't matter. All that mattered to me was saving your life. And I got you out of that house, even though it burned me. And I had to deal with it and had to get so many surgeries and grafts and things to make me whole. And I suffer the pain to this day, but it doesn't matter because I was able to save you." And when the little girl heard that story, She hugged her mother and cried. And from that day on, she was no longer ashamed of her mother. She no longer wanted her mother to drop her off away from the school. She wanted her mother to drop her off in front of the school every day, because she knew that every time she looked in her mother's face, she didn't see hideous scars. When she looked in her mother's face, she saw how much she was loved. She saw how much someone was willing to sacrifice in order for her to have life. And she loved her mother all the more. And I believe that when we get to heaven, we will see Jesus as scarred and deformed as he was from the brutality that he endured from the cross. And every time we look in his face, we will see how much we were loved. We will see how much the God of the universe loved us, how much he was willing to endure on our behalf in order to give us life. And if you think that that makes Jesus less, and if you think that those scars make him hideous and you don't want to see that, then you would need to question whether or not you're really a Christian. I really think you do, because if you don't want to see what Jesus went through for us, and if you're so concerned about appearances, if you're so concerned about physical beauty that you don't want to see what Jesus went through and don't want to understand what he did for us, then again, you need to question whether or not you're really a Christian. I think we will spend eternity marveling at what the God of the universe did for us because he loved us. And I will ask you again, is it wrong for Jesus to have retained all the scars that he endured, all the suffering that he endured for us? And is it right for us to ignore those scars and to portray Jesus as a pristine corpse, as this beautiful, glorious thing that has no evidence of what he went through for us? Which one is more valid? Do you really think that Jesus would make himself pretty again, but just retain a couple scars here and there? Why would he do that? Does that sound like Jesus to you? The only reason to keep the scars in your hands and feet inside, but make yourself pretty otherwise, would be if you were vain. Do you really believe Jesus is vain? Do you really believe that he would make himself look beautiful, but just retain a couple scars just for appearance's sake? Do you really believe that Jesus is more concerned with appearance than he is with the sacrifice that he made for you? Is that what you really think of your Savior? If it is, again, you need to question whether or not you're really a Christian. So I'll ask you one more time. Is it wrong for Jesus to have retained those scars? When you get to heaven, what Jesus do you expect to see? Do you expect to see the beautiful, handsome, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, goateed Savior that you see in pictures on your church wall or in your church bulletins? Or do you expect to see the Lamb as he had been slain, as John says in Revelation chapter 4 and 5? Do you expect to see Jesus retain those scars so that we look in his face and see what he did for us? And if you'd rather not see that, if you don't want to see what Jesus went through, you just want to see a perfectly preserved, beautiful man, then ask yourself, are you more concerned with reality or with vain appearance? Do you want what's real, or are you more concerned with the pride? Do you want Jesus to look pretty because that's what you like? Or do you want to see what he really went through for you? All right, I'm going to wrap this up. I've gone over. Apologize for that, but I really needed to get this out. In the next podcast, we're gonna keep going with what we're talking about now. We've already talked about the secular myths of Jesus, and we began this podcast talking about some of the Christian myths, and we're gonna get into a few more Christian myths about who Jesus really was, because I would contend that many of the things we believe about Jesus, not only just how he looked, which is a big part of it, but what he said, what he did, are not really who Jesus was. And in the next podcast, we're gonna start talking about the real Jesus. And when we're done, I think you're going to start to realize that most Christians, maybe even you, have not been worshiping the real Jesus. We've been worshiping an idol that we call Jesus, an idol that we've shaped in our image, as opposed to looking at what Jesus really said and did, what he really stood for in the Gospels. And there will be a huge dichotomy between that. And maybe, again, you might realize that you haven't been worshiping the real Jesus. You've been worshiping an idol. And if you're mad at me now, oh, just wait. It's going to get so much worse. You're going to be really mad at me in the next couple of podcasts as we talk about the real Jesus. And I can't wait. All right. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it. Please leave me your comments. I want to hear them and read them on Facebook, and or preferably here on the website. And I will talk to you next week when we spend a couple of podcasts looking at who Jesus really was.